Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 697, Christian Fundamentalism and the Underground Reich. This has been recorded on December 13th of the year 2009. Once again, if many of the things that I talk about during the supplemental discussion of this program seem strange, intelligible, overly cute, what have you, I appreciate that. Spitfirelist.com. That's the website. It's got my entire life's work up on it, available for download for free. It is hands down the best website for information of this kind. Please use it, because increasingly an intelligent use of the SpitfireList.com website is essential to a real understanding of For the Record. Now, what we're doing in this program is taking advantage of the fact that an important new book called The Family, subtitled The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power by Jeff Charlotte, is making the rounds, so to speak. It's getting a fair amount of publicity in journalistic and academic circles and developing a certain amount of gravitas because of that. It's doing the NPR round, so to speak. And in this book, Jeff Charlotte has chronicled how Christian fundamentalism, which a lot of Americans, despite the fact that it is obviously a powerful and ubiquitous element, or up to a point ubiquitous, is not really taken seriously as part of American power structure. And what this book does is to show how Abraham Vereide, a Norwegian immigrant who founded the Family, or the Fellowship, as it's also known, in the 1930s, not only was sympathetic to fascism, incorporated fascist and Nazi ideas into its program, but even more importantly, was networking with the Third Reich in its pre-World War II and early World War II period, and then, perhaps even more importantly, in its post-war underground manifestation, in order to not only rehabilitate Nazis for their work in the, quote, new, unquote, Federal Republic of Germany, but also to incorporate them into elements of U.S. intelligence. And beyond that, an axis is formed here. This networking, as we've been calling it, precipitated not only the relationship between Washington power structure, American financial and industrial elite, and Christian fundamentalism, but in turn those elements networked with German power structure and with the underground Reich, this networking in considerable measure facilitated by the Family. And what we're going to do is jump right back in where we left off in Side 1. We're going to be taking a look at Abraham Vereide working dining out on the U.S. tab. He successfully lobbied the State Department to be permitted to go over to Germany, where he and his fellow, quote, evangelists, unquote, including, quote, rehabilitated, unquote, Nazis like Manfred Zapp and Baron von Ginant, basically helped to recruit Third Reich alumni for service in the, quote, new, unquote, Federal Republic of Germany and in elements of the U.S. intelligence establishment. And these networks were inextricably linked with the Christian fundamentalism that has become a major feature of American electoral politics in the last several decades. Of Abraham Vereide's work on behalf of the West to recruit Nazi alumni for the Cold War, we read of Abraham Vereide, known as, again, just Abram here, so influential was he. In the West, Abram wept with them. Even in the West, he believed, quote, atheistic devotees of subversion, that is, those with strong anti-Nazi records, concentration camp survivors, had been elevated by an American military government blind to the threat posed by its eastern ally. Nominal membership, unquote, in the Nazi Party was being held against good Christians with the necessary experience to govern. A coalition of leading German churchmen begged him to intervene, asking only that none but Christians be given authority. In Frankfurt, Abram, with the churchmen and the pillars of the Third Reich to whom they introduced him, quote, the most intelligent, honest, and reliable people of Germany, unquote, settled on a plan. They would provide Abram with a list of imprisoned men, war criminals, unquote, according to the view of a certain unchristian element among the Allies. Abram's friends in the military government and back home in Washington would certify them as, quote, men not only to be released, but to be used according to their ability in the tremendous task of reconstruction, unquote. That September, U.S. Secretary of State Jimmy Burns, under the advice of General Clay, delivered in Stuttgart a world-changing address, Restatement of Policy on Germany, unquote. The burden of reparations would be lessened, Germany would be allowed to keep more of its industrial base, and the purge of National Socialism would soon come to an end. It never was the intention of the American government to deny to the German people the right to manage their own internal affairs as soon as they were able to do so in a democratic way. In Frankfurt, Abram claimed, God personally revealed to Abram a key man to quietly help manage the internal affairs of Germany's elite, Dr. Otto Fricke, an austere German churchman with an uncomfortable past. You are God's man for this hour in Germany, Abram told him. Had Abram asked about Frick's role in Germany's previous hour, Frick would have begged off explaining his activities during the Third Reich. As a radio preacher, he had been recruited by Joseph Goebbels himself to propagandize, charged with explaining to the German people the decadence of jazz. And again, one of the primary people that was recruited by the fellowship and Abram Varide was none other than Hermann Joseph Abs, one of the Third Reich's principal bankers. And again, note here, because we're going to develop this further, that Abram Varide was networking with German evangelists and with Third Reich alumni and basically lobbying the U.S. occupation government to change the sorts of people that they were putting in power and basically to put in power people who were recommended by the pillars of the Third Reich. This one last paragraph again before we see what this resulted in. In Frankfurt, Abram, with the churchmen and the pillars of the Third Reich to whom they introduced him, quote, the most intelligent, honest, and reliable people of Germany, unquote, settled on a plan. They would provide Abram with a list of imprisoned men, war criminals, unquote, according to the view of a certain unchristian element among the Allies. Abram's friends in the military government and back home in Washington would certify them as, quote, men not only to be released, but to be used according to their ability in the tremendous task of reconstruction, unquote. How did that pan out? Continuing with the family. Gadot was among the least tainted of the men that Abram and Fricke, and later Gadot himself, gathered into prayer cells to help forge the new West German state. But they were repentant men. This they testified to at every session. Repentant for what? It was hard to say. Every one of them claimed to have suffered during the war years, men such as Hermann J. Abs, Hitler's banker, and a vice president of Abram's International Christian Leadership, or ICL, German division, Gustav Schmelz. Again, note here before continuing that Hermann J. Abs, in addition to being here, as we've noted so often, Hitler's banker, was vice president of Abram's International Christian Leadership, German division, continuing with the people that were rehabilitated by Abram Varide. Gustav Schmelz, a manufacturer of chemical weapons. Paul Rohrbach, the hyper-nationalist ideologue whose conflation of Germany with Christianity and most of Europe with Germany had inspired the Nazis to understand their war hunger as divine. And General Hans Speidel, who had accepted the surrender of Paris on behalf of the Führer in 1940, insisted that he had never believed Hitler had been forced into his arms by the Red Menace, had regretted that unfortunate alliance with such a vulgar fool, a disgrace to God's true plan for Germany. They had done nothing wrong. They, too, if one gave it some thought, were victims. Perhaps some of them were. That is one of the many clever strategies of fascism. Persecution belongs to the powerful, according to its rules, both to dole out and to claim as the honor due martyrs. Abram did not ask questions. He simply took out his washcloth and got busy with the blood of the lamb. He scrubbed his new men clean. Did it work? Abs, Hitler's banker, became Adenauer's banker, a key figure in the West German government's financial resurrection. Schmelz kept his factory. Rohrbach rode on, authoring tributes to Abram's international Christian leadership in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. And Speidel? He was a special case, a co-conspirator with Rommel in the attempted assassination of Hitler, the July plot of 1944. There was something almost American about him. Like Frank Buckman of America's Moral Rearmament Program, parenthetically, an organization that was very sympathetic and allied with fascism, sympathetic to and allied with fascism, and like Barton, he considered Hitler's racial policies a distraction from his really good ideas. For this ambivalence, the Allies rewarded him. He served as Commander-in-Chief of NATO ground forces from 1957 to 1963 when Charles de Gaulle, unpersuaded of his reconstruction, insisted on his ouster. By the way, Hans Speidel was the fellow who received the surrender of French forces in World War II for Hitler. And again, in Commander-in-Chief of NATO ground forces from 57 to 63. Continuing. Such men are only a few of those whom Abram helped, and by no means the worst. There were Zopp and von Gienot. There were little Nazis, unquote, Abram championed for U.S. intelligence positions, and there were big ones. Baron Konstantin von Neurath, Hitler's first foreign minister, and General Oswald Pohl, the last SS commander of the concentration camps among them. For those beyond hope of blank state reinvention, Abram and his web of Christian cells pled medical mercy. Von Neurath, sentenced to 15 years for crimes against humanity, was released early in 1953. Abram took up his case upon learning from von Neurath's daughter that her father, classified as a major war criminal, unquote, was receiving less than exemplary dental care in prison or expediency. It was unjust, they felt, that Oswald Pohl, the last SS commander of the concentration camps, who, while imprisoned by the Allies, wrote a memoir called Credo, My Way to God, a Christ-besotted path that did not include acknowledging his role in mass murder, should be left wondering when he would be hanged. Again, it was the wisdom of Abram that this was cruel. Continuing, when occupation forces charged Abs with war crimes, he offered a novel defense. He did not deny what he had done for Hitler. He simply declared that he had done it for money, fascism be damned. He would gladly do as much for the Allies. And so he did, a task at which he so excelled that he would become known as the Wizard of the German Miracle, unquote. His past was forgotten, a phrase that must be written in passive voice in order to suggest the gentle elision of history in the post-war years undertaken by those eager to see a conservative German state rise from the ashes, a sober son of Hitler's fatherland that would inherit the old man's hatred for one radicalism, but not his love of another. I would note, too, that the fellow who usually received, in addition to Hermann Abs, but the fellow who was the first economics minister of Germany was Ludwig Erhard. He succeeded Konrad Adenauer as Chancellor of Germany. Erhard was, in fact, a member of the Kleine Arbeitskreis, one of the working groups that liaised the SS with top German industrialists and financiers at the end of World War II, or during the closing phase of World War II, and that helped to set post-World War II German economic strategy. In turn, Ludwig Erhard was a protege of a fellow named Otto Ohlendorf, a Nazi war criminal who was executed. Otto Ohlendorf also was the focal point of lobbying by Abram Vereit, or just Abram as he came to be called, and the family or fellowship here. What we're going to look at here is Abram Vereit's work on behalf of Baron von Gienot, again, the Gestapo chief in North America, one of the people with whom Manfred Zapp networked in the pre-World War II period, and one of the people along with Manfred Zapp who worked with Abram Vereit and the family, basically, in helping to put Nazis back into power in the, quote, new, unquote, Federal Republic of Germany. Speaking of a fellow named von der Rapp and his embrace of a uniquely American form of fundamentalism, and then discussing the fact that American fundamentalism per se didn't gain that much gravitas in Germany. It certainly did not take hold in Germany, but it evidently made an impression on Abram. Perhaps, too, on von der Rapp's fellow aristocrat Baron von Gienot. The two would have met often at Abram's private conventions of Germans and Americans. The difference was that von der Rapp, never a Nazi official, could travel and spread his ideas at Abram's international meetings. Von Gienot, on the other hand, was bound to the fatherland. This, he complained to Abram, was an impediment to Reconstruction. He'd wanted to attend a conference in Atlantic City with further ideas of expansion in mind. Would the American military really say that a man of his stature would blemish the boardwalk? He was on a list of undesirables he had learned from certain connections, probably ICL men within the occupation. This would be understandable, unquote, he thought, if he had been a communist, but again, quoting, but I don't see any sense in including people of my attitude, unquote. Ex-fascists ready to make common cause with the United States. Among the many testimonies von Gienot collected on his own behalf was a letter from an American diplomat's wife who insisted the Baron had not been a Nazi so much as an idealist, unquote. Again, this guy was SS and the Gestapo chief in North America. Eventually, in the United States, I should say. Eventually, von Gienot had believed, quote, the good and conservative element of the German people would gain control, unquote. Fascism had been like strong medicine, unpleasant, but necessary to what von Gienot had always believed would be the reestablishment of rule by elites like himself. In the coming years of Reconstruction, his advocate wrote, such men will be needed who can be trusted, unquote. Abram contacted the combined travel board that decided on which former Nazis could be allowed to leave the country. The Baron was needed, Abram insisted. There were high Christian councils to be held in The Hague. Expedite the necessary permit, unquote. Should that argument prove inadequate, Abram hired von Gienot's wife, Karin, as a hostess on call for Americans traveling on Christian missions. She was an American citizen, though she'd spent the war with her SS officer husband. Now her American passport was being threatened, but Abram saved it. That summer, he sent the Baron and his wife a gift of sorts, a congressman from California to be a guest on the Baron's estate. The following winter, Senator Frank Carlson visited. As you know, Abram advised Varine, he is one of the closest friends and advisors to Eisenhower, unquote. A serene confidence has filled me, she replied, as to President Eisenhower's guidance by God, unquote. That summer, her husband flew with her to England, his passport evidently restored. What we're going to look at next, again, is Abram Varide, although he's not present here, but his because he was ill, the family networking at Castle Meinau in Germany with members of the German elite. And in this, we're going to be taking a look, and also some American diplomats, we're going to be taking a look at the establishment representatives or establishment members of the Underground Reich and the above-board establishment forces that had networked with their American counterparts, the family and Abram Varide having helped with that networking. Of the family and the networking with the German elite at Castle Meinau. The first meeting at Castle Meinau had taken place in 1949, the same year the Allies allowed Germans to begin governing themselves again. The 1951 meeting was planned to mark what Abram considered the complete moral rehabilitation in just 2 years of Germany. Abram wanted the Americans to go to them, a grand contingent of senators and representatives. Gadot, now the unofficial leader of the German organization, was thrilled, but when word came that official duties in Paris prevented the American delegation from attending, he was furious. There was more bad news. Chancellor Adenauer, Gadot's keynote speaker, was called away to a crisis, and Abram himself, slowed down by mere bad health, would not be there. His representatives could take notes. Of the people who were assembled, however, at this meeting, General Speidel was there, as was Rohrbach, the propagandist. There were representatives from the major German banks and from the Krupp and Bosch firms, and there was the president of Standard Oil's German division. There was at least one German cabinet member, parliamentarians, mayors, and a dozen or more judges, a U-boat commander, famed for torpedoing ships off the coast of Virginia, cut a dashing figure, a gaggle of aristocrats, minor princes and princesses, barons and counts and margraves were intimidated by some of the best minds of the old regime. There was the financial genius Hermann J. Abs and a fascist editor who had once been a comrade of the radical theorist Walter Benjamin before throwing his lot in with the Nazis. Wallace Haynes spoke for Abram. He stayed up all night before his lecture, praying for the spirit that spoke aloud to his mentor. The Americans, God told him to say, were thrilled with the eagerness of the Germans to forget the war. The Americans came to the Germans humble, he told them. Haynes brought proof of their newfound wisdom, a letter of repentance for the sins of denazification signed by more than 30 congressmen, including Wiley and Capehart, and a young Richard Nixon. Basically, what we have is the family networking between the German elite, the establishment and above-ground and, quote, respectable, unquote, members of the Underground Reich, and the American elite and power structure, and in turn, the family is communicating sympathy for the easing of denazification rules from key American congressmen, including Richard Nixon. As we're going to see, the family was deeply involved in helping to bring that to pass. And in fact, the denazification rules, as we have seen so often, were very much relaxed. In addition, the family was deeply involved in the networking that was to result in the rearming of Germany, including the putting back into power of many heinous war criminals. Recall that the first Inspector General of the German Armed Forces, the equivalent of our Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was General Adolf Heusinger, who was not only in charge of the Oberkommando der Heere, German high command, but he also he planned every German military campaign from the invasion of the Soviet Union on, was inextricably linked with the Gehlen organization, and was a war criminal. Of the family's role in helping to successfully lobby for German rearmament and the inclusion of former war criminals and or SS officers in the German military, we read, Senator Wiley, again an associate of Abrams, wanted total war. Take the men of Hitler's old panzer divisions, bless them under Christ, and point them toward Moscow. Abrams' German point man, Otto Fricke, wasn't so bloodthirsty. He merely wanted 25 rearmed German divisions to show the Russian invasion, to slow the Russian invasion he saw coming. What do we Christians think of rearmament? Was the theme of one of Fricke's cell meetings in 1950. They were conflicted, tempting to take malicious joy that the Allies are now forced to empty with spoons the bitter soup that had been served by the Russians, unquote. The judgments at Nuremberg had dishonored the Wehrmacht, and the dismantling had insulted and robbed Germany's great industrialists, Krupp and Weizsäcker and Bosch, all well represented in Fricke's cells. By the way, Fricke was the former Nazi collaborator who worked for Joseph Goebbels and who was one of the point people for Abrams' operations in Germany. Continuing, by all rights, they should stand down, refuse to rearm, let the Americans defend Christendom from the Slavs, but there it was, Christendom. They were Christian men chosen not by a nation but by Jesus himself to lead their people into the order God revealed to them in their prayers. To accomplish these tasks, the Frankfurt cell concluded, the state needs power, and this powerfulness is indispensable for the sake of love. And so Germany was indeed rearmed. And as we're going to see too, Manfred Zapp and other members of the family were very successful in helping to effect not only the easing of denazification, but basically the purging of the American occupation government of anyone who was sympathetic to the original denazification orders, including the plan on the part of former Secretary Henry Morgenthau, who had launched Operation Safe Haven to interdict the German capital flight program. Any former advocates of Morgenthau's deindustrialization and denazification of Germany plan were purged from the Allied occupation government. And one of the things to note here is the networking between Abram and the family, and among others, John J. McCloy, U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, former chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, one of the key people involved in forming the Black Eagle Trust, and later a key member of the Warren Commission, helping to cover up the assassination of President Kennedy by many of the same elements in this fascist milieu. Of the family's role in helping to facilitate the successful easing of denazification and the purging of hardline anti-Nazis from the American occupation government. For years, Manfred Zapp had been Abrams' harshest correspondent, constantly warning that, quote, the man on the street, unquote, with whom he seemed to spend a great deal of time, had had enough of America's empty promises. America had committed mental cruelty, he charged, holding, quote, so-called war criminals in red coats, the uniform of the Landsberg prison, awaiting execution indefinitely. Abram agreed and sent to the occupation government letters signed by dozens of congressmen demanding action. America prevented German industry from feeding the nation, Zapp argued. Abram agreed and intervened time and again on behalf of German factories. He saved as many as he could, though a steel foundry named for Hermann Goering was beyond even his powers of redemption. America had put leftists and trade unionists and Bolsheviks in power, Zapp complained. Abram agreed. The cleansing of the American occupation government became an obsession, the subject of his meetings with the American High Commissioner John J. McCloy and his weekly prayer meetings with congressmen. Idealists, unquote, were prevented from serving their people, said Zopp. The man on the street was losing faith in the American religion. Quote, freedom in their interpretation is the ideal for which we shall fight and die, but the reality is nothing else but a beautiful world for services of Western powers. The word freedom is not taken seriously anymore. Unquote. Within a few years, nobody cared. The Morgenthau boys were as much a part of the past as the history no German cared to speak of. Parenthetically, of course, that was the history of the Third Reich. And in this regard, again, I'm going into this book because it's getting a fair amount of gravitas, and I wanted to show how the Underground Reich and the elements about which I speak so often intersect with and network directly with not only the linchpins of Christian fundamentalist power, but in turn with some of the other power elements with which the Underground Reich is affiliated. We're going to conclude the program, first of all, by taking a look at a passage from the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Ries. This was published before the Normandy invasion in 1944, and it's a discussion of the Third Reich's plans to go underground, and one of those plans involved networking with American Protestant fundamentalists. Quoting Kurt Ries here, again, writing in 1944 before the Normandy invasion, this book available for download for free on my website, spitfirelist.com. Kurt Ries writes, again, in early 44, also of interest to Berlin, particularly in view of the coming underground fight of the Nazis, must be fundamentalist Protestants, who have a considerable following in Michigan, Kansas, Colorado, and Minnesota. To be sure, some of the fundamentalists are among the most courageous fighters for democracy, but a great many of them are definitely pro-Hitler. Their reason for this stand is that fundamentalists do not believe in freedom of religion, and they do believe that the Jews should be punished because they killed Christ. They say that Hitler has been sent by God to quote, save Christianity and destroy atheistic communism, unquote. To many of them, Japan is the oriental outpost of Christianity, unquote, destined to save Asia from the danger of a communistic China, unquote. And we're also going to review what Major General Reinhard Gehlen, the Third Reich's Eastern Front intelligence chief, who later moved with his entire organization first to the CIA, then NATO, then the, quote, new, unquote, Federal Republic of Germany. After his formal retirement as an intelligence officer, Gehlen got into evangelical religion, although the evangelical church here is probably the Lutheran church. But it's still, the fact that he became a Christian activist is more than a little interesting. From Gehlen's Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, writing in 71, today, on the threshold of 70 years, General Reinhard Gehlen has found a surprising new field of activities. He has become an evangelist. With still unimpaired energy, he has taken over the direction of a campaign for building new churches and schools for the evangelical church in Catholic Bavaria. After a life of seclusion, he frequently attends meetings all over the province at which appeals for new funds are launched. On occasion, he does not disdain to visit members of his religious community in order to encourage the enterprise and to pass the begging bowl, unquote. Why, how inspiring. Reinhard Gehlen became an evangelist. Again, spitfirelist.com, that's the website that features not only the Nazis Go Underground, but a vast, it's by far and away the best website for this kind of information. It has my entire life's work up available for download for free. Please utilize that. And increasingly, an understanding of these programs is hinged on a reasonable use of the spitfirelist.com website. There's also a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. If you don't like what you see, there's no better way to fight back than supporting that work. This concludes For the Record, program number 697, Side 2, Christian Fundamentalism and the Underground Reich, being recorded on December 13th, 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.